I'm Sarah.
And I'm Paul. And we're just checking to make sure you're listening.
Because at this point, you actually are. We're pretty deep into the season. And like we were during season one of Prison Break itself, because by this point in the season, we were actually making the show while the show was already airing. And there was that was very exciting.
It was cool. And this is fascinating for us because we're like reading your comments on our Instagram and email and everything at the same time that we're putting together these episodes. So it feels like there's a sort of organic feedback thing going on. We like it, is what we're saying.
Yes. And also, when this show started, the kind of interneting along with your favorite TV show was a pretty new phenomenon. And we all kind of got to experience the beginning of that in real time. And that was exciting. But we are really grateful you're here listening with us. The feedback has been great. And we're just so glad you're tuning in, is an expression I'll use, even though that might not be what you're doing.
And while we're, forgive me, Paul, I know you're going to hate this, but just because, like, of the gratitude side, it's been really lovely to do this with you. You know, we don't get a chance to spend that much time together, and we've gotten more. This is, like, actually probably the most time we spent together since we did the show. And I'm happy about it. And I know you can't take a compliment any better than I can. So we'll move on. Your, like, inner neurotic person is dying right now. So I also want to briefly shout out our producer, Ben Haber, who has learned how to do literally everything podcast related for this show that is way beneath his level of experience and creativity and expertise. And he's been a star about it.
Yes. Thank you, Ben. He is our fearless leader, and he takes the brunt of the work, and we get to do the fun part. And because you can't take a compliment either, take my love and appreciation for doing this, because it's just so, it's great spending time with you and chatting about this stuff.
Aww.
I appreciate us doing this together. It's been a joy. Also want to give a shout out while we're doing it and feeling grateful to John Nunziata, who designed our logo. Speaking of doing work kind of below his pay grade, what he did for us is incredible. The logo is so cool. And it's going to make for great merch and great prizes for our contest. And he put up with a little bit of actor neuroses while making our logo. And it was kind of better than we dreamed it could be. So thank you, John.
Enough now. We're going to do the index before somebody thinks that this is like a Smurfs rewatch.
Smurf me some of that Calistine.
I would smurfing love to. This episode is called J-Cat. It was written by...
Which stands for, do you know what it stands for?
Oh, no. Do you know what it stands for?
Okay. I did. It was mentioned in a previous episode. It has something to do with the psych ward, right?
Yeah, it does. I don't know. I don't know what it stands for, but I bet the fans will write in and tell us.
Yes.
This was another one written beautifully by Karen Usher, directed by the great Guy Ferland, who we'll talk about later. It first aired on April 10th, 2006, to a rating of 8.12 million viewers in the 8 p.m. slot now. Because 24 took over Fox's 9 p.m. Monday night time slot. Damn you, Kiefer Sutherland. So we were now up against Wife Swap on ABC, King of Queens on CBS, and Deal or No Deal on NBC.
A summary of the plot reads, Sarah reports finding the uniform material on Michael's wound. Pope sends Michael to solitary. Michael feigns insanity. Bellick decides to hire professional workers for the guard room. Sucre covers the escape hole and gets caught out of his cell. Also sent to solitary. Michael is taken to the psych ward. His plan is to speak with
Charles Potoshek, I think.
A.K.A. Charles Potoshek, a.K.A. Highwire, a Haywire who can help him with his damaged tattoo. LJ tracks Kellerman down at his house and ambushes him alone. And the police arrive and arrest LJ.
It's a lot. Okay, pop culture at this time. On April 5th, beloved host Katie Couric announced that she would be leaving the Today Show to anchor CBS Evening News, which was, I mean, at least for me, it was kind of the end of an era. Like, the Today Show was on while we had breakfast for, like, basically my whole childhood.
Really?
April 8th, a couple days later, started Daniel Powder's five-week reign on the Billboard 100 with his single Bad Day, which...
Don't know the song, don't know the artist.
Well, it's got to be, did you have a bad day? Tell me don't... No? Is that not him?
Oh, okay.
Because I was just... By the way, I apologize for butchering that song, but I feel like you would sing that really well. On April 9th, golfer Phil Mickelson won the 70th Masters Tournament, his second of three wins.
In world events, on April 10th, former Enron chief executive Jeff Skilling came out swinging in the first moments of his testimony at federal district court in Houston, declaring, "I am absolutely innocent."
Absolutely innocent. Sorry.
Iran announced it had successfully enriched uranium, raising international concerns about a nuclear program.
Speaking of explosives, here's a rewatch clip. Oh my God, it's avocado.
Oh my God, that man is large.
That's why they named him Avocado.
I remember getting this script and just being in heaven. Just an absolute actor heaven.
That's how you get undressed.
I just ripped my clothes. I just ripped clothes on. I was like, what are you? You're going to take the time to pull it over your head?
Yo,
like,
buttons? So, no.
Ugh, come on. Buttons
no.
Children.
Crazy. I remember hearing that alcoholics sometimes have a sweet tooth.
Mm-hmm. You're like, I'm going for that.
And I was like, we're going for the cake. I think I had cake and chocolate milk. I'm not even sure you see it. I think this is just for me. What's the plan here, LJ?
Well, he's got a gun.
Yeah, he's going to go do crimes. I'm so relieved that Andy Rothenberg isn't in these scenes, because if I found out that he was and we were in a scene together and I forgot about it, I'd feel like such a jerk.
Wow. Okay, and with that, we'll be right back to talk about it.
Welcome back, Fishes. Let's talk about this episode. Okay, you got notes. I got notes about Owen Kravecki. I gotta say, Kellerman in character is one of my favorite things about this entire show. Obviously, my favorite is Lance. But please tell me about Owen Kravecki.
You know, it's one of those great acting lessons where I think we talked about this early. You know, when you get somebody like Sarah or Kellerman in a pilot, there's not a lot of information there. So you kind of make up a person. And then as you go forward, and I don't imagine the writers knew there was going to be an Owen Kravecki as they started breaking the season. I mean, maybe they did, but I certainly wasn't filled in on it. And it's one of those, again, we keep talking about theater acting. You know, when you do a play, it doesn't change. It's the same. Yeah. You know, you know everything there is to know. So it's kind of a Bible, and it's kind of like all the information you need is there. And when you're doing a movie, it can change as you go along. But TV is really the only like continually serialized form where you get information about your character sometimes deep into a run where you're like, oh, I came up with this thing. I'm from North Carolina. Da, da, da.
Are you telling me you didn't have on your bingo card that you were a Buffalo jerky salesman?
It was so exciting to get the script and see that and say, oh, now I get to do this. And then there was the kind of actor insecurity of like, do I have to pretend to be a different guy? How would I do it? And da-da-da-da. And I remember Guy being super helpful with that. And
Guy's the director of this episode.
Oh, Guy's the director of the episode. Because, you know, it's kind of a funny scene. He's pushing buffalo jerky on this cop. And what what I remembered is that, you know, people with maybe personality disorders are good at manipulating people.
Mm. Kellerman has a personality disorder?
I mean, I think he has some sociopathological tendencies.
Okay.
Sure.
Not full-blown Bellick.
He murders a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it starts ramping up. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the kind of detachment that he needs in order to do his job.
I mean, in theory, he would have killed LJ. Do you think he would have killed LJ had the police not intervened?
I mean, he had a gun on him. It's a good question.
Yeah.
And that's a good question. Probably.
I mean,
And made it look like, you know, he had broken in or whatever, as he actually had. I didn't have to make it look like.
Right.
It's just great when you get something like when you're playing somebody and you get stuff to do like that, and all you really have to do is execute what's given you, and everybody says, "Oh, your character's so three dimensional." And you're like, "That's because they made me pretend to be a whole different guy."
And you didn't chew the scenery with it. Do you know what I mean? There's a version where it's like, "Oh, I'm Owen Kravecki, and I sell buffalo jerky." Do you know what I mean? Like you go full Fargo,
right?
Which, by the way, I love everything about Fargo. At least the movie. I've never seen the TV show, but I. You know, as with most things with your performance, the restraint actually is part of what worked because he just felt super believable. It was
As long as we're on that scene, it was first time I was ever squibbed.
Ooh.
And it was on my shoulder.
Right. So you got to not look in that direction.
And you got to really not look in that direction. And the first time you're squibbed, it's fine because it surprises you. The second time you're squibbed, you know it's coming and it's like being slapped on camera.
It's hard to not.
It's almost impossible not to flinch.
It. Yeah.
But, you know, it was right next to my ear and all that. And it was blood and it was so fun. And
did it get hot? Sometimes they get hot, the charges. No?
I don't recall it getting hot. Okay. But I remember it had to be relatively large because that was a wool overcoat I was wearing.
Yeah.
And it had to rip a hole in it.
Yeah.
They also had maybe three. And I remember Rachel and Lizzie. And can't remember the...
Rachel and Lizzie in hair and makeup?
Wardrobe.
Okay.
No, wardrobe.
Okay.
We're like, yeah, one of these is squibbed. And then we have an extra and Fox doesn't need it back. So do you want an overcoat? I was like, oh yeah, I love an overcoat. I have that overcoat. I think I still have it.
You know what's funny? I actually have a Dr. Tancredi overcoat too. I don't remember how it
Those
came.
Those days are over, by the way.
They are. Oh no. Yeah. Oh, now yeah. They can't. You can't. Nothing falls off the truck anymore.
Yeah. And for the audience listening, they used to do a thing that was totally sanctioned where they would allow you to purchase your clothes kind of a cut rate. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes they would just give stuff to you. And then a lot of times it would just go into a warehouse and then executives and their families would just go in and pick stuff. I think those days, I think now with corporate oversight, that stuff is over.
I did a show for NBC a few years back and my character had all these great sweaters. And they were like, yeah, you can buy them for 50 cents on the dollar. And I was like, wow. Okay. And that's when I discovered that half of my sweaters were like $700. I was like, I'm not somebody who spends $300 on a sweater.
I was on a show a couple years ago playing Kevin Hart's manager on a show where he kind of played himself based on a real guy who's kind of a sneakerhead.
Oh,
and Kevin's a sneakerhead. And I was, so every day, almost every day, I was wearing a different pair of Jordans.
Amazing shoes.
And I would like look them up. And you know, the guys on set that knew this stuff
would
be like, oh, those are the 86 North Carolina.
Totally.
Blah, 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 blah. And I would look them up and they'd be like $2,800.
That's bananas to me.
They're beautiful. I don't know if I'd pay that.
Did you keep any of them?
Oh, no. They were there was people watching them at all times, it felt like.
What are you here for? I'm here to guard the sneakers.
I'm the sneaker wrangler. Okay.
Sneaker wrangler.
I just wanted to make something occurred to me in this episode that may be obvious, but they do a really interesting thing with Hope, with the warden. And it's been going on throughout, but it especially goes here, you know, when Michael says, you've been good to me and my brother, it's sincere. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You know, he's not a bad guy. And they've humanized him with the story about his illegitimate
Toledo,
son.
Yeah.
Drug addiction and Toledo and all that. But he does seem like, he's tough, but he does seem like a fair guy. And he kind of believes in what he's trying to do. And I think a lot of shows would have just made him kind of like a Shawshank monster. Uh-huh,
uh-huh. The sheriff.
And then so my point is, I think it's so interesting how these writers make characters that are kind of brutalizing the leads more sympathetic. Even Kellerman, once you've introduced Michelle Forbes' character,
Brinker makes him look.
I don't know if it's sympathy, but you see that this guy now has. There was no obstacles for Kellerman before. It was just, he could just kind of move through the world. And now he doesn't know the vice president's been nipped, but even she, who has this kind of ulterior motive, almost evil motive with her brother, now she's having her stuff questioned and she's being forced into a corner. And so it just makes everybody more conflicted, makes them more human.
No, and one of the things I really liked is when you say this was always about you and your family, and most importantly, the country. There's something about that.
I specifically asked for that.
I wondered because I looked it up. And I was like, that's not in the script that I had.
It's not?
No. But what I like about it is all of a sudden you become an ideologue. Like, this is a man who believes in something. He may do bad things for it, but he's not somebody who's just about his own agenda.
Oh, no. And I think we talked about that in the mm-hmm. maybe in the first or something. But, you know, when I did, this is like peak War on Terror.
Yep.
Era. And I did a lot of reading about Special Forces, a lot of reading about Secret Service, a lot of reading about people who enlisted after 9/11. Mm-hmm. You know, the mm-hmm. sense of I'm doing
patriotism,
things outside the law, but for a greater good. Yeah. I think that's only when you're looking for how can someone do what Kellerman is doing, where he's either a psychopath or he believes mm-hmm. he may have sociopathological tendencies, but he does. I think there is just no other way to do it other than he believes
he's a patriot. Yeah. You know, a small thing, when we had that first conversation about it, I think I said, I used to have this coin that was given to me by the Secret Service that trained me on the Secret Service pilot that I did for ABC that went nowhere. And I found, like, tucked away in a bunch of stuff I took from set, you know, just like papers and call sheets and stuff, this Secret Service coin, which I am told beats any other coin if you put it down. With military folks. So I just, all these years, I've been like, I lost this thing and I feel terrible. So anyway, that's my stupid Secret Service story. I want to talk about Guy Ferland.
Yes, our director.
If memory serves, this was one of the, if not the, first episodes that he directed. His career was very, very, very new. And it was interesting because we had all these super experienced folks. And Guy, I tried to get him for this episode, but he's directing someplace far-flung and in the wrong time zone. But we'll have him on eventually because they had all these really high-level directors, the Brad Turners, the Mike Watkins, the Kevin Hooks. I mean, the people with big careers, most of whom were coming off of 24 or something else with Fox. Mm. Mm. And Guy came in, knocked it out of the park.
Mm-hmm.
Would go on to direct two episodes of the reboot in season 5. But in the meantime, would come onto Walking Dead. He did a bunch of Sons of Anarchy. And he did the episode on Walking Dead where my character died. And so he's killed both of us, you and
I. He did the episode in season 5 where my character died.
Yeah. And he and I actually became really close during that episode. He was like, I want to go sit down and figure out how to do this properly. And there's even a picture I think I posted on Instagram a couple of years ago about, like, he's lying on the ground with me while my character's dying. It was just so, so, so sweet. And when it came time for me to say, okay, I need to learn how to direct, I called him and I said, can I shadow you? And I ended up shadowing him on an episode of Timeless for NBC. And he's kind of been a mentor ever since. So this is my Guy Ferland love letter. He's marvelous. He did a beautiful job in this episode.
In the thing where I died, I felt so empowered and like he knew Kellerman.
Mm.
I was involved in a way that made me feel super comfortable. And not that I had felt marginalized or anything, but it was very collaborative suddenly and it then became super fun.
Mm-hmm.
We just had so much fun.
He's great with character.
And this is character like, have to make a smoothie because there's a line about it.
Yep.
Get a gun, go through the house, and then do a headshot and a gut shot. And
yep.
It was a whole thing.
It was a whole
and
thing.
He was just wonderful. We had such a good time. And then I was on the plane with him on the way home, which was lovely.
Oh, fun. By the way, speaking of Kellerman and things Kellerman, do you have a little show and tell for us?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to do that?
Are you going to do that here, even though it's only audio?
Well, I mean, we can show people a clip later or something, but I think it would be cool, like, to fold into this Kellerman conversation and the things I unearthed from my attic conversation.
I found a script, but that's not new. I found the things that Fox gave us to give to people.
Oh, the headshots.
The headshots.
Yep.
I found this.
Your chair back.
Chair back. I have every chair back ever, I think.
You know what? I think I've got one somewhere too. What do you do with them? Do you like?
I put them in a box.
Okay, I thought maybe you put chairs on.
And I look them. No, I can't. And then I have this, which is that's Brando's writing, not Marlon Brando, our prop masters.
Brando, the props. He's holding up a glasses case.
I'm holding up a sunglasses case. These were the Kellerman sunglasses.
If you put them on, does it go gong?
Boom.
Oh my God, they look so good.
I much research on this. Because again, when you don't have a, when there's not a lot there, you kind of are like, okay, I got to make up a guy.
Right.
I wanted to wear aviators, but I did not want to wear the Ray-Ban, you know, the, the like flight boy aviators. Right. These are like the 60s flyboy, right stuff aviators that Don Draper wears.
Oh, okay.
We're way before
you
that.
You got there way before Don Draper.
I know, but I almost posted a thing on Instagram, like a picture of Kellerman and a picture of Don Draper, like who wore it better, and it would be like, he wore it better. he looks great. That's John Hamm, everybody.
That's John Hamm, everybody.
But there is, growing up, near my house in Chicago, there was a Army-Navy store with real, it was like when I think a lot of Vietnam guys sold their stuff to these Army-Navy stores.
Yeah, all the surplus and stuff.
Pins and sunglasses and all the surplus stuff, or they got it from the Army. And I always loved that place. And so there is one here, a famous one, that's like at Cahuenga and Melrose.
Yep, I've seen it.
Where I would get these sunglasses. And I brought these to, you know, it was a whole thing. I went to Matt and Paul. And I was like, I think he should. Don't make me, you know, a lot of times on TV, they don't want you wearing sunglasses. Mm-hmm.
No, it's a reflection issue. Yeah.
Pants to your eyes. No, well, they coated these.
Oh, okay.
And if they coat them, that means there won't be a reflection. The camera won't be reflected. And there's a thing they can do. But I really fought in the first couple episodes, like, please let him wear sunglasses outside. I mean, it's a thing. And they let me do it. And then the other thing was I went and found that I also went and found the Special Forces pin that Kelly wore on every suit, even though I think I had it on upside down, which is super embarrassing.
We all make
mistakes. But it was also a sign that trouble. Like if they wear it upside down.
Oh, yeah. Like a flag upside down, nation in distress. Okay.
And then this, which I wore in every scene.
Oh, the Kellerman ring.
Kellerman ring, which is, this is the 82nd Airborne ring. A lot of Special Forces come from 82nd Airborne. And I found this ring in Chicago at one of the Army Navy stores. And I bought it. And it was one of those things where I was like, I just, to the prop people, I was like, please don't lose this. I need it.
Yeah.
But it was really one of those things where when I put my suit on and I put this ring on.
Yeah.
What was that?
That was the guy.
It was just mad. It was, there was something talisman magic about it. Like I just felt like him.
Well, because you were so far, you're so different from Kellerman. And I mean, that, which is not to say that Wentworth is Michael Schofield or Dom is Lincoln, but like on every job, there are people for whom the Venn diagram between themselves and their character is bigger.
Getting to put on any kind of uniform, like such a defined, I know it was just a suit and tie, but that's what the Secret Service guys, that's the uniform, felt like armor. Also, I will also say this, walking on set, you know, if we were at the prison or I was the only one in a suit.
Yeah, there's a status thing there. People treat you differently. And you know,
stand up straight and all that stuff.
That was something that I was thinking about watching this episode. Because this is really the episode where Tweener, you know, we've seen him turn into the rat, but this is the first time that he really kind of gives something major away that could endanger the dudes, the guys, the breakout team, the Fox River 8. And, you know, it makes me think about the way sometimes audiences conflate a character and the actor playing them and how challenging that was for Lane in his life, you know, and I'd love to talk to him about it at some point. Obviously, when he was, you know, incarcerated himself, I think it became terrifying to him. But even before that, it can be really odd to have fans hold you accountable for words you didn't write and character decisions that you don't make. And in some very perverse and weird way, the better you are at it, the more the audience loses the ability to say, well, that's the actor and that's the character.
I can't, it's one of the things that surprised me, you know, the boundary thing surprised me when people started recognizing me. It made me think a lot about how it's scary it must be as a woman. to be recognizable, especially if you're playing somebody who's been sexual on screen.
Super.
But I also felt I was super lucky that Kellerman was really the first thing I ever got recognized for. Which, you know, no one was going to come up and fuck with Kellerman.
Yeah,
they'd come up and talk to you.
Right. That's really interesting.
I was friends. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, but I'm good friends with T.R. Knight, who plays a lovable character on Grey's Anatomy. And people would come up and pet him.
And what him?
Pet. I mean, it was like, yeah, he's just like lovable, blah, 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 blah. And so people just felt like, that's who he is. I can just, it's George.
Oh,
I'm just going to go
run
up and grab him. Yeah. And, you know, so I felt really lucky that I played, you know, a killer.
Someone with boundaries.
You'd get recognized, but it didn't feel like that. Later, Private Practice, Girlfriend's Guide, a couple other things, I would get yelled at for, especially in romantic. Like, why did you do that to blah, blah, blah? And, you know, I'm sure you've had it too, which is can be fun and funny when it's not out of control.
I mean, I've had people call me a whore in front of my children after Walking Dead.
I mean, it's insanity.
It's problematic for all kinds of reasons, including the the gender problems, whatever. But like I developed a pat answer, which is, I'm an actor. That's a role. This is my family. I'd like you to leave now. But like, I mean, it was crazy. And actually for me, it was a bit of a head snapper because Dr. Tancredi had almost a universally positive response from fans. And with Walking Dead, I was looking for somebody that would not be kind of the, you know, the good girl. But when I got it, I was like, oh, I didn't quite expect the full treatment. Anyway, you know, I think about it, especially with Lane, and what that is like. And I'd love to chat with him about it. I also have a whole list of things we never got to talk about way back from when we were watching The Skin and the Teeth, because we got so involved with Mac. You mentioned something about insane asylums and shooting, and J-Cat takes place in an insane asylum.
Yeah, J-Cat, yes, which was a stage, I imagine. Or was it at the prison? Was it at Joliet?
No. I seem to remember us shooting it in a different wing of the prison.
Did Fox River, is that because of Fox TV? Did I literally just put that together? That was kind of a little wink to Fox?
Oh, dear God in heaven. If you did, I did too. I honestly don't know. We got to ask Olmsted or Sherry.
Yeah. Just in the way that we were talking, and multiple people, the directors, writers, actors have all said, you know, you go into Joliet Prison, where John Wayne Gacy was, where people were put to death, which is a gothic-looking building. You feel that stuff. It's different. There's some kind of thing there. Well, a lot of times, because healthcare industry is so healthy in America, there's a lot of abandoned hospitals. And a lot of times you go and shoot in abandoned hospitals because there's obviously a lot of space, and done that a bunch of times. And then I've shot in a
psych ward.
Insane asylum. Is that the proper mental hospital? I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know what the
shot in a mental hospital on Roosevelt Island in New York.
Amaury used to live on Roosevelt Island, which is crazy.
There's like two apartment buildings on Roosevelt.
Yeah, apparently he lived in one of them.
So you already feel isolated and weird. And
Roosevelt Island, for those who don't know, is in the middle of, what is the Hudson River?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's weird. It's this itty-bitty island.
Yeah. But it was this abandoned hospital, and like literally with like water and like in the basement. And we're filming a comedy.
Oh no, you're a comedy?
CBS, half-hour comedy.
Oh, dang.
And my character was having a funny operation, and I was playing Deborah Messing's husband, and we went to lunch, and I was in a hospital gown, and we go down into the basement to eat lunch, and it is creepy, like abandoned wheelchairs with one wheel spinning, like Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah, dude.
Creepy.
It's the worst.
No. And then after lunch, we get into the freight elevator to go upstairs. It's me and probably 12 Teamsters, New York crew, none of whom I know, and we get stuck between floors.
Oh, shit.
And I don't know if you've ever been stuck on an elevator.
Mercifully, no. And I'm knocking all kinds of wood right now.
And this is like in a hospital where you're like, this place, I mean, they're running, there's no electricity here. They're running
right, this is a Jenny.
The whole building. And we were in there like, not a short period of time.
And you're in a hospital gown.
And I'm in a hospital gown. And I had that whole thing of like,
was your butt
they're going to come in here and they're going to come in here and think I'm a like escape patient. Oh. No proof that I'm,
my
you know.
God.
Yeah, it was really, and then you had to go do like the lightest, funniest scene.
Oh, I can't imagine. I mean, I've shot quite a lot in a very notorious place in Vancouver, which is called Riverview, which is a former, it's a former mental institution, but it's a complex. It's many buildings. And it is, in fact, I've been told it's the, at any given time, there's like 3 or 4 shows shooting there. It's one of the most active filming sites around. And it's haunted as fuck. And one of the stories that I heard from, I was directing in a building, and the sound mixer was like, just don't go downstairs. And I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, these floors are okay, but downstairs isn't okay. And I said, okay, everybody's got stories, but like, are they real? And he goes, oh yeah, here's what happened to me. He said, when I started out, I was a boom operator. And my sound mixer said, there's something going on downstairs. I'm getting an echo. Please go make sure that all the doors are closed to the rooms. So, you know, it's a ward, right? So there's a dozen doors or something. He walks down the hall, closes them all, turns to go up the stairs, legit hears something, feels a breeze on his neck, turns around, all 12 doors are open again. And he just went upstairs and he's like, somebody else is going to have to close those doors. I'm never going back down there. Like, it is... One of the things I love about our jobs is we get to shoot in all kinds of crazy places. I've shot in Masonic temples. I've shot in cathedrals. Like,
yeah.
But there are times where you're like, oh, I need a psychic bath when I am done here because this is not okay.
All right. I want your top. One occurs to me, but I want to hear your favorite. Not favorite, but like, oh my God, I can't believe I get to be in this space. Just real quick, top of your head.
Oh, oof. I mean, honestly, I think the closest that I would come is this crazy Masonic temple because I've always been really curious about what's in there.
Uh-huh.
And we got to shoot in one in DC, you know, like a real big deal one. Again, for this failed Secret Service pilot that Clark Johnson directed. I always say I starred in the first thing Clark ever shot that failed. We've been friends ever since.
Congratulations.
But it was amazing to just kind of look around at this place. And every time you took a step off set, there would be someone from the temple being like, you can't go down here. You can't. Yeah, please go back to where you can't go down here. So, of course, my husband waited until everybody was focused on something else and like went prowling and, you know, discovered.
Entered
every single reconned. How about you?
Two come to mind. One was... I'm an enormous Bulls fan, and they won their first championship in L.A. at the Forum against the Lakers. And I got to shoot on the floor, not during a game. I think, had Staples already been built? Maybe Staples had just been built, but the Forum was still there. And it was still the Lakers floor. Wow. And we got to shoot on that floor. And I went and stood, like, where Jordan stood when they won the championship. Yep. I stood where Paxson shot those shots to hit three.
That's cool.
I had to do that. And then also on a different movie, also in L.A., we shot next to the abandoned, now torn down Ambassador Hotel.
Mm.
But our lunch was in the Ambassador. And that's where Bobby Kennedy was killed.
Wow.
In the kitchen.
Wow.
We broke in. We like snuck into the kitchen.
And we, of course, have stories about the grassy knoll in Dallas when we get there. I will say, you know,
I have pictures of me on the grassy
knoll. I know you do. The coda to that, actually, not a coda, but another answer, I think. We got to shoot on a real live C-130, giant aircraft for season 4 on a runway. And that was pretty bananas to be like, oh, thank you for lending this to us, Air Force. That was amazing.
Did we talk about the show on our...
I think so. A little bit. Okay. I don't really have too many more notes on the show.
I have something about avocados. Is that a thing? Why was that guy called Avocado? For no apparent reason. That's just a scary nickname.
Maybe because he was shaped like an avocado?
Okay.
I don't know.
I only had one other thing to talk about, but we're kind of out of time. I can push it to next time.
We're pretty close, but do you want to try it?
No, we're going to talk about eating on film, but we can do that later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did we not do that? I feel I told a story about that. The Walking Dead story.
Well,
yeesh.
No, save it for next time.
All right. Okay. Well, with that, we'll be right back.
And we are back. And we're back. Okay. So this was sort of show and tell week. I showed some of my original props here. And Sarah has a bit of a surprise for us. It's, what do you got there? Fan mail. Is that right?
So, okay. I found some fan mail from season one that I had found and answered and kept. And I looked through some of it. I found this one letter that was kind of cool. So I wanted to share it with you guys as part of our sort of fan wrap-ups. And in some ways, this is another sort of artifact of pop culture in the mid-2000s, because fans would write to you. And as you just, you know, showed us, and Fox would issue us in-character headshots, they would write to us, and we would sign the headshot and send it back to them. And, like, I remember once a month, you know, they would dump off a big thing of fan mail, and my husband and I would sit there and answer it. And that doesn't really happen so much. What, like, okay, here's a
question. I got one last week.
Did you?
My manager, yeah.
But what do people ask you for now?
An autograph. They'll include a picture to be signed, yeah.
Because to me, everybody wants selfies. That's like, selfies have replaced the autograph in my experience.
Of course, that makes sense.
Which is interesting. Okay, so here's a letter, and I'm going to read the whole thing. And if we decide to cut we can. To Sarah Wayne Callies, care of the William Morris Agency, which is where I was at the time. Dear Sarah, I am a chief petty officer in the United States Navy, stationed on board a submarine homeported in Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in Georgia, and a huge fan. We will be deploying very soon, and I would be honored to receive an autographed photo of you to display on our submarine. On board the submarine while deployed at sea, the entertainment world provides us one of our only sources and reminder of home. We're currently looking to decorate our cruise lounge with autographed celebrity photos. The cruise lounge is the only place the sailors of the crew can go to watch movies, listen to music, and read magazines. Time off is at a premium while underway, and the movies and magazines are a source of great pleasure and the only way the crew can unwind. We're hoping you would help us out by sending us any autographed photographs so that we can frame them and display them on the walls and in the display case that has been designed to hold mementos obtained by the crew. We're very proud of the limited space we have. We would be very proud to display your autographed photo on the submarine. Thanks in advance for your time. David Alberts, YNCSS, United States Navy. I got to say, of all the fan mail that shows up, it's all special in its own way, of course. It always means something a little special to me when it comes from the armed forces.
That's a lovely letter, by the way. Thank you for sharing it.
It's crazy.
I did a Goodwill tour October.
Yeah, right before you started recording this.
The thing that he said about, we heard it over and over again, because I was like, what am I providing? I was so glad to do it, and it was such a joy, and it was fascinating, but I was like, do these people care?
I would have that thought, yeah. Like, why do they care about me?
Yeah. Why do they care, you know? It's nice to hear that it provides comfort is the wrong word, or entertainment, you know, just entertainment. Just nice to be able, I'm just really not saying this right.
No. I know what you mean. There's something about, like, you know, the idea that we get to be a part of a story that made the cut meant the world. So I got to say, if David Alberts of the United States Navy is out there, hey man, thank you for sending that. You know, I'm married into a military family. So, you know, to everybody serving overseas, you know, thank you for your service and thank you for doing what you do. There you go. You want to wrap us up, Paul?
Let's wrap it up. Okay. We have a call-in topic for this week because our call-ins have been great. The call-in number is 401-3-P-BREAK. 401-3-P-B-R-E-A-K. This week, our topic is fan fiction. Fan fiction kind of exploded right as Prison Break hit the world. I mean, because people were interneting and connecting about shows, and there were message boards and fan fiction
exploded all over the place.
So, oh yeah, call us and tell us: did you read fan fiction? Did you write fan fiction? If you read it, were you traumatized by it? Were you inspired by it? We'd love to hear from you, especially if you wrote it. We'd love to hear if you're still doing it. What happened to some of your fan fiction? We don't know if we're allowed to share fan fiction. We probably are not.
But
we want to hear what your interactions with fan fiction are.
Tell us your fan fiction stories.
If it's still going.
Absolutely. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our watch party episodes on Patreon. The link is on the show page, wherever you're listening right now. And, you know, also remember, don't get sent to prison. But if you are sent to prison, Paul, don't room with someone who's named after a fruit or vegetable.
Yeah.
You can do better than that.
I'm out of everything I want to think of is just inappropriate.
Oh, all right. Now I'm super curious.
Do they let you have iPad? No, you don't get...
I don't know.
You don't get content in prison, do you?
Well, they used to watch TV. They used to watch the show.
They have TV. That's crazy.
That's bonkers.
Okay, ask me again.
All right, Paul. Remember, don't get sent to prison. But if you are sent to prison...
Take care of your teeth.
Take care of your teeth. That's good advice. All right, everybody. I guess that's it for us. We'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, we're grateful. And Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, but maybe getting closer to it. Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden is producer Ben Haber.
Love him.
Getting us all caught up in the prison yard is editor and sound designer Jeff Schmidt. The front man of our jailhouse rock band is Paul Edelstein, who made our music.
It's true.
Taking the nightly headcount is production assistant Drew Austin. Our Prison Break tattoo artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. And follow us on John Nunziato. And follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at pbpodcast@caliber-studio.com or call us at 401-3-P-BREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Our head of jailhouse rock is Paul Edelstein, who made the music for this podcast. Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor, the great Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliber-studio.com and call us at 401-3-PBREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you.